butter. Can we buy Superman peanut butter?
Our brand's fine, honey.
Have you ever tasted Superman peanut butter? Its strength is its great taste.
Mmm, delicious. Smooth and creamy, a real fresh roasted peanut flavor.
It's nutritious too.
The Good Housekeeping seal. Must be good. It did taste terrific.
Superman peanut butter. Its strength is its great taste.
You're listening to the Hollywood Saloon.
Die. At least tell me your name.
It's not who I am underneath, but what I do that defines me.
Bruce?
Superheroes can be informally organized into categories based on their skills and abilities. Character subtypes might include the Brawler, a hero who engages in direct physical conflict. These heroes are known for the ability to deliver punishment and to take at least some degree themselves. Spider-Man and Wildcat are both examples of brawlers. The martial artist is a refined version of the brawler. The martial artist hero usually has physical abilities which are mostly human rather than superhuman, but possesses phenomenal combat skills. Some of these characters are actually superhuman, such as Daredevil, Iron Fist, and Wolverine, while others are normal human beings who are extremely skilled and athletic, such as Batman and other related characters. The Brick/Tank is a character with a superhuman degree of strength and endurance and usually an oversized muscular body, such as The Thing, The Hulk, and Colossus. The Blaster is a hero whose main power is a distance attack, usually an energy blast, such as Cyclops, Starfire, and Static. The Elementalist is a hero who has powers over some natural element or part of the natural world, usually giving them a range of powers with a pseudo-scientific explanation, such as Storm and Polaris. The Marksman is a hero who primarily uses weapons, typically guns or bow and arrow-like weapons, or other projectiles like knives or boomerangs. These weapons often have a variety of specialized functions like explosives, glue, nets, rotary drills, etc. Green Arrow, The Punisher, Longshot, and Batman are examples. The Mage is a hero who is trained in the use of magic. Doctor Strange and Doctor Fate are examples. The Gadgeteer is a hero who invents special equipment that often imitates superpowers such as Forge, Night Owl, and Gizmo. The Armored Hero is a gadgeteer whose powers are derived from a suit of powered armor such as Iron Man and Steel. The Teleporter is a hero who can disappear from point A and rematerialize at point B, sometimes just by themselves or sometimes with others in tow, and sometimes even able to project it as a weapon, such as Nightcrawler and Magic. The Speedster is a hero possessing superhuman speed and reflexes such as The Flash and Quicksilver. The Mentalist is a hero who possesses psionic abilities such as psychokinesis, telepathy, and extrasensory perception, such as Professor X, Jean Grey, and Saturn Girl. The Shapeshifter is a hero who can manipulate his or her own body to suit his or her needs, such as stretching, such as Mr. Fantastic and Plastic Man, or disguise, such as Changeling and Chameleon Boy. A Size Changer is a shapeshifter who can alter his or her size, such as the Atom, Colossal Boy, and Hank Pym. The Mastermind is a hero who remains behind the scenes and often sends others to do their work for them. This is sometimes combined with the Gadgeteer subtype, but is unique enough to stand on its own merits. Nick Fury is a good example of a mastermind, and in some cases, Professor X's as well. These categories often overlap. For instance, Batman is a skilled martial artist, a marksman with proficiency in the boomerang, and a gadgeteer. Very powerful characters such as Superman, Dr. Manhattan, Silver Surfer, and Martian Manhunter can be listed in many categories. Welcome to DC vs. Marvel Battle 2. Part one was all about Marvel. If you haven't listened to that one, I would suggest you go back and listen to that one before you jump into the DC story, just because that's our timeline going here. But yes, we're doing DC today, and this is DC at the Movies, although there's a lot of television, there's radio, there's all this kind of stuff. But you are in the Hollywood Saloon, and I am Andy, and with me, of course, is Human Film Database, John Jansen.
Hello, and welcome all.
That's right. And so here we go, jumping back into the superheroes, the comic book heroes, the DC world.
You know what image I have in my mind right now? The very first images of Richard Donner's Superman film, which I always thought was really great. It had the very small little window, like a 1/66 screen, and it had the little child going through the pages of the comic book, Action Comics, one by one.
I remember.
And it stops on the Daily Planet, and then boom, suddenly the curtain pulls back, and it becomes widescreen, and we, you know, fly off into space. And, well, let's do that right now with the history of DC. Start us off.
Let's jump into the pages of the comics with DC history.
Beginning in 1935, the fledgling company that was to become DC Comics produced a series of comic industry milestones. The company launched a brand new industry by publishing New Fun Comics, the very first comic book that consisted entirely of previously unpublished material. Several years later, Detective Comics No. 1 became the first comic book devoted to a single theme. In 1938, DC again made history with Action Comics, featuring the debut of Superman, thereby giving birth to a new superhero genre. Shortly thereafter, another milestone character, Batman, was introduced in the pages of Detective Comics. The popularity of the superhero resulted in the introduction of many fantastic characters in the 40s. Amazingly, many of these are still popular today, such as The Flash, Wonder Woman, Green Lantern, Plastic Man, as well as the first super team, the Justice Society of America, which was followed years later by the Justice League of America. Throughout the 1940s, 50s, and 60s, comics became a widely popular medium, and comic book characters found their way into most other mainstream media. DC comic characters such as Superman and Batman were featured in cartoons, radio, movies, and live-action TV shows.
So as you can see, DC has a deep history, being the first superhero comics magazine that was ever available. And they jumped into other mediums as well pretty quickly when that started coming around. And as we talked before in Marvel, really the first place to start off was the medium of the time. And that was with radio.
Boys and girls, your attention, please. Presenting a new exciting radio program featuring the thrilling adventures of an amazing and incredible personality. Faster than an airplane. More powerful than a locomotive. Impervious to bullets.
Up in the sky, look.
It's a bird.
It's a plane.
It's Superman.
The first radio show for superheroes was Superman. And it was huge. I mean, and it lasted for 11 years. From 1940 to 1951. And this starred Bud Collier, who played Superman and Clark Kent. And the thing that's very interesting about this is he was unbilled at the time. From 1940 until 1946, they kept him a mystery. They would not let you know that this was Bud Collier, who was the voice of Superman.
It was Superman on the radio.
He was Superman on the radio. And so they wanted to maintain this illusion and his secret identity. But, you know, that ended in 46. But Bud stayed on as the voice of Superman throughout his career. He voiced Superman in the Fleischer cartoons. And later on, even into shows that we know as kids, in the 60s, certain animated series of Superman. And it's interesting is that radio was very different at the time because you had to have a weekly program no matter what. There was no rerun or anything. And some of the shows they would design around Bud Collier's schedule. So they'd use a plot point such as like Superman being held captive by, you know, there'd be kryptonite and he'd be in a closet somewhere. And so then Bud Collier would cruise off to vacation and the incidental players would be looking for Superman to try to find him. And that was interesting. And even now and then they would bring in Batman and Robin before they got their own series. Well, on the serials, and they would be in Superman, the radio show as well. So that was a huge hit.
The first crossover?
Oh, definitely. That was the first crossover, absolutely, between Batman and Robin and Superman. But then after that, you know, times change, and it was, you know, we were going to jump from the radio to the big screen, not in feature films yet, but serials, you know, and of course, like we said before, this is, you know, week to week, you'd come back and there'd be another, you know, serial, you know, I don't know how long they were, 15 minutes or something, and they'd have a little story for you. But in 1941, we got The Adventures of Captain Marvel. Now, this was, it was actually from Fawcett Comics, not DC Comics, which at the time was called National Periodical Publications. And what happened was they, Republic Pictures, went to Superman and said, let's do a serial now. But they said, no, our radio show is popular enough. We don't want to, you know, water that down at all. And so they went to Fawcett Comics and picked up Captain Marvel. And that became the first superhero that was ever on the silver screen. The first realized in live action superhero was Captain Marvel rather than Superman.
Hmm.
So, and it was pretty, it was a high class show and pretty popular at the time. Now, in 1943, Columbia Pictures brought out The Batman. And this is our first time to see Batman. Batman was the first DC character to ever appear in a serial. Lewis Wilson is Batman. Douglas Croft is Robin. Premiered the Batcave. There was no Batcave before that. That's what was interesting, but it was called the Bat's Cave. And it later changed to Batcave in the comics because of the serial. And it was made during World War II, again, you know, 1943. So there was a lot of racial slurs. And I read this is that later on when they put the series back out, as a revival, they chopped it up and edited it because they thought it was too controversial. You know, they would call people yellow and whatnot, you know, the Japs and whatnot. So offensive. But later on, they've now really released it on DVD, and it's uncut, good stuff. So that was our first real taste of Batman, was in 1943. Now, in 1948, Superman would finally come over to the serials. Now, this was pre-George Reeves. This was Kirk Allen. And this became the most successful serial of all time. And every time you saw Superman fly, that was animated. So it's very interesting. If you've actually seen this footage before, and I've seen it, is he goes to jump, and then all of a sudden, bam, he's animated. And sometimes the surroundings are animated. So it's actually pretty funny. But at the time, they just didn't have the technology to do that. But that was hugely popular. In 1949, we continued with Batman and Robin.
Famed headquarters of those relentless crusaders for law and order, Batman and Robin.
This was the follow-up to The Batman. Robert Lowry was Batman, Johnny Duncan is Robin. It was lower budget than the first series, but it was considered better because the acting was better. It was more action-oriented. 1950, Atom Man versus Superman. This is, again, a follow-up to the Superman serial. And this is when the world was introduced to Lex Luthor, except he was just called Luthor at the time, and he was also Atom Man. And he fought Superman, again played by Kirk Allen, and it was a 15-chapter serial. Now, other serials of DC in that time were Hop Harrigan in 46, The Vigilante in 47, and Congo Bill in 48. But these were all hugely popular serials that you could go see from week to week, and were just a big hit. Okay, and now the next area that the DC world would jump to, and again, you know, we're jumping from medium to medium, and that's really the exciting thing, and we said it in the last show also, is that superheroes have crossed just every medium that you can imagine, from one to the next to the next, and the next jump, of course, was to back to the small screen on TV shows.
The United States Treasury Department presents The Adventures of Superman.
Than a speeding bullet. More powerful than a locomotive. Able to leap tall buildings at a single bound.
Look, up in the sky, it's a bird.
It's a plane.
It's Superman. Yes, it's Superman. Strange visitor from another planet who came to Earth with powers and abilities far beyond those of mortal men. Superman, who can change the course of mighty rivers, bend steel in his bare hands. And who, disguised as Clark Kent, mild-mannered reporter for a great metropolitan newspaper, fights a never-ending battle for truth, justice, and the American way.
In 1952, the world was introduced to The Adventures of Superman. Now, this is George Reeves. Now, George Reeves, this is not his first time as Superman. He was returning from the feature film called Superman and the Mole Men, and we'll get to that in a little while when we jump onto our movie timeline. But this was, he was returning, after the success of that film, he was returning to television, and that's when we got The Adventures of Superman. And this was a hugely popular series. It lasted from 1952 to 1958. So, you know, we had a strong 6 to 7 seasons going there. The first two seasons were filmed in black and white because back then you watched it on black and white. But the seasons after that were filmed in color, and it's very interesting because color didn't really become standardized until like the early 60s. And so back then, you know, even though they shot it in color, you got it in black and white. But today, we can watch it in color. So they were very forward-thinking, you know, in what they were doing. Mm-hmm. And so that was really cool. Now, hadn't you told me that you've actually seen a lot of this series?
No, I haven't actually seen too much of the George Reeves. I mean, I grew up on it, and I did watch it, because it was on. So that's how I remember it. And especially, you know, Lois and Jimmy and, you know, those incarnations.
Right.
But, you know, like a lot of people, I knew that, but, I mean, it would all be rewritten in 78, of course.
Of course. But, sadly, in 1959, as they were mounting, Superman had gone off the air, and they were going to actually revive the show and bring it back because of the popularity. But George Reeves died, and the general consensus is that it was suicide.
Mm-hmm.
But there's also been some conspiracy in there also.
Well, it's one of Hollywood's greatest mysteries.
Right.
You know? And there's a few of them, and that's a very famous one.
Well, and it was the beginning of what they would maybe call the Superman curse.
Mm-hmm.
That, you know, might go over to Christopher Reeve also. But, yeah, that was a really sad day because, you know, that's who Superman was George Reeves really owned that role. And, again, it wouldn't be until many years later till it would the mantle would be passed on to someone else.
Fear not, America. They are still on duty, that legendary duo, still humbly withholding their true identities under the guises of a noble flying rodent and a commonplace backyard bird.
To the Batmobile!
But what's this? That's no tricycle, citizen. Holy femininity!
Batgirl! Batgirl? Batgirl? Batgirl?
Zap and Zonk. Dip and splat. What reassurance for those sounds. Well, the dynamic duo now becomes the tremendous trio. Batman in color on ABC.
...1966, DC's next big series. It would take a few years, but they would jump in with Batman. And this is, you know, Adam West.
Burt in Ward, color?
Batman in color, that's right. And hugely popular show. It had three seasons, and it's really, I mean, you know, what can you say? This was the one that really set Batman up. And what I've read here, and this is very interesting, is that Batman creator Bob Kane noted that this series saved the Batman comic series from cancellation when the show revived the character's popularity. Despite this, most comic book fans despised this series for stereotyping superheroes and comics as campy nonsense. Furthermore, soon after the show was canceled, the character's comic series took on a dark and deadly serious tone that was reminiscent of the original comics in the late 1930s as a reaction to the TV show's light touch. Now, this is interesting because we're going to see the same thing repeated in the future.
Yeah, that is interesting. And maybe this is what's needed for Batman every now and then.
Right.
Because he is available in every single medium. And the story's just been told umpteenth times, you know. Mm-hmm. Occasionally, you have to camp him out so you can reinvent him.
Right.
What I think is interesting about the TV show is it kind of it becomes the blueprint of what's going to be needed for a successful translation for superhero show. First and foremost, you got to have a great theme song.
Absolutely.
I mean, and most of the others, I mean, from Wonder Woman, you know, to Incredible mm-hmm. Hulk, and they all made sure that they had that theme song covered.
That's right. It's really important. Well, the thing that's interesting is they made those theme songs to where you couldn't forget them. They stuck in your mind.
Oh, yeah.
You know, and everyone, I mean, to this day, most people who grew up on some of these shows, I mean, you can sing the song. I mean, everyone can sing Batman, na 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 na. I mean, how many people don't know that? Or Wonder Woman, or, you know, most of them.
And I think also growing up, it was, I think, good for us because it was one of the first times where we had a show that would end on a cliffhanger and we'd have to come back the next day.
Oh, yeah.
You know, and see the others. And there wasn't a lot of that growing up. I mean, Batman was one of the few ones. I mean, there would be, what, an occasional Gilligan's Island that might do it or, you know, something else that might be the two-parter. But a lot of the Batmans were, if not, you know, most of them.
Well, you know,
and, that was always, I always thought that was great.
Well, you know why? Is because on its original run on ABC, is that it aired two times a week.
Mm-hmm.
That's what was interesting, you know. And you know what's really cool too is that that show really set a lot of diction for Americans also, lines that would stick through. I mean, how many times have you heard people say, "Stay tuned, same bat time, same
right.
bat channel."
Sure, iconic.
You know, absolutely. And you know, and Robin with all his, you know, holy this, and holy that, you know, and it was totally over the top. And what was the guy who wrote it? You said he had written
Oh, Lorenzo Simple Jr.
Right.
He wrote King Kong and Flash Gordon.
Right. And so, you know, very campy, very silly, really big at the time. I know that it was a big draw to celebrities. It became mm-hmm. so famous that celebrities always wanted to come and hang out on the set at the time.
Well, and also it had the number two key element for a hit show, the car.
Oh, the Batmobile. What can you say?
I mean, the car can make your show, you know. Starsky and Hutch, the car.
Yep, that's right.
You know, Knight Rider. Oh,
when you
well.
when you think about the Batmobile, which is the first one that goes into your head?
Well, of course, the '60s one pops in my head.
Absolutely,
because that's the toy I had. That's the one I played with the most.
Yeah,
I mean, I wanted that little metal diecast toy that had the little blade that popped out front and the little mm-hmm. rockets that shot out. You
yeah.
know, and then it, you know, if you could get the little boat attachment, you could, you know, pull the boat along.
Mm-hmm.
Now that was cool.
Way cool, way cool. So, yeah, that's what I think. When I think of the Batmobile, I think of that one. I don't think of, you know, the Keaton one or
I did like, you know, I did like the Keaton one. I thought it was a good redesign.
Yeah.
All the way around.
Yeah.
I did not like either of the Schumachers. I mean, those ridiculous fins.
Especially the one with Clooney. Oh, that was awful.
I mean, why would anyone want that? Try get that out of the cave, you know.
Well, why did they design a car that was one seater?
Yeah.
I mean, how dumb is that? I mean, you can't do anything with it, so.
That was really dumb. That was just so they could have more toys.
It was built for destruction. Yeah. And you know, so Robin can have a bike. I mean, oh yeah. Please. We'll get into Batman and Robin later.
But you know, again, I mean, yeah, and I do like the new Batmobile in Batman Begins because of the reality and practicalness
sure.
of it. But no, I don't think anything beats the original.
The original, and yeah, it was just, at the time, it was really popular. Season 3, we'd kick in, and oh yeah, man, here we got Batgirl.
Oh, well, I mean, first, yeah, Batgirl, I mean, that was always really cool.
Yeah.
I mean, if you weren't already in love with Catwoman, though, and you would have a few Catwomans to fall in love with, but, you know.
Yeah,
I'm thinking of, I guess, Lee Merriweather.
Oh, I don't know. I mean, or you could go Julie Newmar.
Julie Newmar, right. Yeah.
To me, that was the one who was hot, hot, hot.
Yeah, she was always hot, hot, hot.
Yeah.
And then what, Eartha Kitt was the other one?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. So there's been a few. There's been a few.
And I like that there's multiples, you know, out there. And,
sure.
You know, the Burgess Meredith Penguin, you know, iconic, you know.
Cesar Romero,
even
Joker.
Joker and Riddler. I mean, they really yeah. own those characters. I mean, so much so that it would leave fingerprints on future performances by big stars.
Right. Right. Absolutely.
And Gorshin as the Riddler.
Yeah, absolutely.
Sharp.
And they even had other people. Remember Vincent Price was Egghead?
Right.
And they had King Tut. And, I mean, the list is just goes on and on and on of how many villains there were. And that was always really fun to see who's going to be the villain this time. But, yeah, for me, the great love of the show was Batgirl. She just was so crazy hot with that outfit. And, yeah, loved it. Like you had said before, in another show, you know, it's like, you know, you wait and you watch. Is this going to be the one where the little bat shadow goes yeah. across the screen?
I'd always wait for that little motorcycle.
Yeah, to see if Batgirl's going to show up. So, so anyways, yeah, that was a huge hit. You know, last for three seasons, it kind of faded out. But, yeah, Adam West would be Batman. And really, he's kind of still Batman forever. You know, I mean, he really stuck as Batman for a long time. And you can't, when you mention Batman, you have to go back to Adam West, even though the show was just so campy and so silly. But, you know, it was meant to be that way. So anyways, after that, we'd have a few years. In 1974, DC would jump into the world of kids' shows, and we would have Shazam.
Chosen from among all others by the immortal elders Solomon, Hercules, Atlas, Zeus, Achilles, Mercury, Billy Batson and his mentor travel the highways and byways of the land on a never-ending mission to right wrongs, to develop understanding, and to seek justice for all. In time of dire need, young Billy has been granted the power by the immortals to summon awesome forces at the utterance of a single word. transforms him in a flash into the mightiest of mortal beings, Captain Marvel.
Now, in 1974, I remember watching the show and loving it.
Oh, Saturday morning staple.
Yeah, absolutely.
CBS.
Absolutely. And the interesting thing is that DC didn't own this character out and outright. You know, like I'd originally said, it was from Fawcett Comics. And after they folded, DC bought it. But for some reason, they still couldn't refer to Captain Marvel as Captain Marvel in the title of any shows. They couldn't market a show as Captain Marvel, hence the title Shazam, which was very interesting. He was still Captain Marvel, and you could refer to him as that. And everything else was involved, you know, Billy Batson and all that kind of stuff. But the main deal was that in the title, it had to be Shazam. And, you know, we remember it for that anyways. And so in 1975, the next year, they changed it to become the Shazam Isis Hour. And they wrote a whole new hero that went along. It was a shoot-off from Shazam, and it was called Isis.
Oh, my God. And Isis.
She's not really a DC character, but, you know, heck, when we were kids, we didn't care. That was a full hour of live-action superhero radness.
Oh, yeah, because it took the concept of a young teenager guy could become this other, you know,
right,
superhero, you
right
know? You know, as opposed to just an adult superhero.
Oh, and how many times when you were a kid did you go, Shazam!
Yeah, nothing calling the gods.
Yeah, nothing would happen. Well, the thing that's cool is that the each letter means something. You know, like, you know, the S and the H and the A. A is Achilles.
Right.
Z is, I don't remember. I have to read it up. But
Zeus, right?
M is Mercury or something. So, or Apollo is A. And, whatever. But yeah, it was great at the time, and I was really, really, really into that character. 1974. We're still doing TV. We're still rocking TV. DC is very attached to television for a while. Now, in 1974, we're going to get our first taste of prime time. Well, that's not true because we have Batman. But in the modern age, you know, 10 years after Batman almost, and we're talking Wonder Woman. Now, this is a movie of the week ahead of time, though, and this was before, you know, Linda Carter. This was Kathy Lee Crosby.
Right, I remember this one.
That's right, and it was just a movie, and that was fine. But I read that Linda Carter had tested for the role, so they remembered her. But it was popular. But a year later, they decided to change it all up, and it was the new original Wonder Woman. And this was a TV movie. They were testing the waters again, just like Marvel did Marvel learned from DC. Actually, you put a movie out first, you see how well it goes, and then you go ahead and go with the show. So it's almost like the movie is a pilot, if you will.
Mm-hmm.
But in 1976, full throttle, here comes Wonder Woman.
Wonder Woman! Wonder Woman! All the world is waiting for you, and the wonders that you do. In your satin tights, riding your outer rights, and the all red, white, and blue.
So from 1976 to 1979, we had three seasons of Wonder Woman. You know, the first, you know, modern superhero in prime time. It set the standard for superhero television, you know, for years and years and years. Marvel would learn from it and jump in there. But, you know, Linda Carter spinning around, turning into Wonder Woman. I mean, we loved her. She was, you know, crazy hot for the time.
Mm-hmm.
In her satin tights, as the song mm-hmm. says.
And the bracelets.
And the bracelets blocking the bullets and...
Mm-hmm.
Oh, yeah, I mean, she was great. And the interesting thing, check this out, was that there was two seasons. Well, in the first two seasons, it was a radically different thing. The first season of the series was set during World War II. When the series moved from ABC to CBS the next year, so it jumped networks to stay on, the entire format of the show was changed, with the immortal Wonder Woman returning to civilization in the late 1970s and teaming up with the son of Steve Trevor from the first season, of course played by the same actor. Lionel, was that Lyle Wagner?
Lyle Wagner, right.
Lyle Wagner. Linda Carter's costume also underwent some minor changes and modifications with the changeover. So, you know, I'm guessing it's, you know, for budgetary reasons, you know, it's like if you don't have to make it
period
a period yeah. piece, you know, set it in modern day.
Right.
Well, and what's interesting is that they did change the mythos of Wonder Woman a little bit, because Wonder Woman never had a secret identity. She was just Wonder Woman.
Right.
You know, or whatever her name was from the Amazonian island, you know, Amazonian island or whatever.
Diana Prince, maybe, or something.
Yeah. Well, you know, maybe she was Diana Prince on the show, but she kind of did a Clark Kent thing, you know.
Right.
She put her glasses on and her hair up, and, you know, they could never tell. And it was, you know, very much a Superman type thing. But, you know, I guess they needed that secret
for
identity
the format
thing for
the show. Right. Yeah, definitely.
Yeah.
Because that's how it was pitched. I mean, basically, it's Superman with a woman.
Right, exactly. When she had the strength and all that, and, you know. But it was a very big hit at the time, and it really set the standard. And as we talked about in the Marvel show, after that, Marvel would jump in, and then they would just take over television at that point, you know, from in the late 70s, and just own it with Hulk and Spider-Man and some Captain America movies and stuff like that. All right, so after Wonder Woman, there was a pretty large gap here, until about 1988, where DC stayed out of television. And that was obviously because they put their attentions into the films, and we had all the Superman films at that time. But in 1988, Alexander Solkine was still trying to keep things going. But this time, he morphed it into Superboy.
Rocketed from a distant planet to a bold new destiny on Earth. Found by a Kansas family and raised as Clark Kent, he learned he possessed the strength of steel, the speed of light, and the desire to help all mankind. He is Superboy.
This lasted from 1988 to 1992, and it was presented by Alexander Solkine. Went 4 seasons. I never saw it once. I just barely even remembered. I don't know how this thing went totally under the radar for me.
Yeah, well, we were in college by then, so yeah. We really weren't watching Superboy anymore.
Yeah, funny enough, finding sound clips and whatnot, there was a bunch of different versions of the intro of the show, and it's so 80s. They'll play a theme reminiscent to the Williams theme, and then it just kicks in with that 80s funk. And it's just so bad that, you know, I can't imagine this show had any kind of quality to it at all. I don't know. I haven't seen any of it. I will definitely give it a shot one day, but I don't know. We'll see. But that happened. In 1990, the famous and the biggest superhero of all time, Swamp Thing, would get his own series. Now, check this out. Two movies and a series. How did this thing last 3 seasons?
3 seasons?
3 seasons, starting in
1990. God. That's good syndication.
Who was watching that?
Somebody.
You know, somebody was watching it. And you know, it was just goofy as all hell. But who would figure that something as campy and silly as Swamp Thing? And I remember reading the comics for Swamp Thing back when I was a kid. I always kind of mixed him up with Man-Thing, which was the rival version over at Marvel.
Right, right.
But Swamp Thing to me was the official, you know, swamp creature. But yeah, I remember that. I never saw the show, don't know anything about it, but there you go. We had a Swamp Thing series for 3 seasons. And still in 1990, they would test the waters again with a TV movie, but this was for The Flash. And then in 1990, that moved into a series. And we had the Flash TV series from 90 to 91. Only 1 season, 21 episodes.
I only saw a couple. I didn't see the whole thing.
I did too. I remember seeing the pilot and watching a few episodes afterwards. Great Kick and Danny Elfman theme. Mm-hmm. You know, and that's one name that we haven't even brought up at all. You know, as we've been talking about all this stuff, and we could probably talk about it more in the final battle, is that a big name that reverberates through the entire superhero, you know, movie and television genre here is Danny Elfman. Just a huge voice and all that, but we'll get to that. But anyways, The Flash, John Wesley Shipp as Barry, or The Flash, Amanda Pays was in there. And if you remember, Mark Hamill came on as the Trickster.
Right.
And I specifically remember watching that episode because, hey, it was Mark Hamill, you know, in a very silly costume. But Mark Hamill at that time was really popular doing a lot of voices for comic book shows. the Joker and whatnot.
Yeah, he eventually becomes the Joker.
Yeah.
Yeah, I remember, I mean, I thought it was okay, The Flash. I mean, it would be almost new if I resaw it. But I had one nitpicky comment about it is I'd always liked the fact that The Flash kept his uniform in his ring.
Right.
I always thought that was so cool in the comics, you know, being an eight-year-old kid or whatever. And he could just, like, flip the lid and it would just pop out. Mm-hmm. And he was so quick that he could just, you know, yeah. jump right into it.
Yeah.
And I want to see that effect. And obviously, they just couldn't do it.
Yeah, they could do it
in
today.
That time. But today, when they do the Flash, I'll finally get to see it. So that's exciting.
That was one thing about that Flash was that the costume was kind of weak. It was like really muscular bound. Do you remember that? It was like there was more padding in the suit.
It seemed like it suffered from Batman syndrome. They were trying to do the Batman costume on the Flash.
Yeah, they were trying to build out those muscles and. Yeah, I think you're right. Well, you know, it was very Batman oriented at the time because, you know, you got Elfman doing the score. Mm-hmm. And definitely they were saying, let's do Batman for television. And that was, you know, that's the way they went. It was interesting. The thing that's very cool is that the DVD set just came out and you can get it's like the entire series on one set.
Yeah, that's great.
So that's definitely something I will probably get into one day just for the memory sake of it. But
so we wouldn't hear from The Flash again until Smallville, huh?
That's right.
Wow.
One of the best episodes of Smallville. So in 1993, they're going to jump back in. How many incarnations of Superman can we have? You know what I mean?
Oh, let's see. Moonlighting was a big hit, but it's already been canceled.
So, hey, why don't we take Lois Lane and Clark Kent and do the same thing?
Oh, what a great idea.
Lois and Clark, The New Adventures of Superman.
But you know what? I think we need to make the S on his chest even bigger.
And let's put him in some tight, shiny, aerobic workout uniform spandex.
Straight out of the 80s, right off the rack.
How cheap was that? I want to see chicks wearing that stuff, not him.
Not him.
No. You know, I want to see Terry Hatcher wearing that outfit, not him.
Right.
But, I never watched this show.
I know. I tried.
Yeah, and I think it was a lot more female-oriented, possibly, Superman. It was really more about that relationship.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it was kind of a chick show. It lasted from 93 to 97, so it was four seasons long. So, I mean, it was popular. I mean, it lasted. Dean Cain is Clark Kent Superman. Terry Hatcher is Lois Lane. Terry Hatcher's gone on to have a real successful career with Desperate Housewives and whatnot. They played with the canon of Superman quite a bit. You know, probably more so than any show up until Smallville started doing it. But in season three, they got married. And the interesting thing was that on the show, they coincided it with the wedding in the comic books. And if you remember, that was a big media deal.
Right.
That they kind of talked
about.
I
remember. Yeah.
And so they did that on the show. So anyways, that was Lois and Clark. Wish we could tell you more, but we don't know much about it. I definitely want to give it a try sometime. But not yet. Five seasons so far. We're about this time. We're about to jump into season six.
What an interesting pitch that must have been. You know, it's like we want to do Superman, but as a prequel,
right?
And he'll never fly, and he'll never wear the suit. Mm-hmm. But they went for it.
They went for it, and I'm glad they did. I mean, you know, it was a great idea.
And Lex would be his best friend.
Which makes it. That's the best dynamic of the show, and we've talked about this show quite a bit before. You introduced me to the show, and I'm eternally grateful that you did, because seasons 1 through 3 were just absolutely fantastic. Sure, there was some goofy stuff, you know, we've talked about the Freak of the Week and all that, but it moved the story forward. you know, there was someone for him to battle.
Mm-hmm.
And we needed that.
As much as we love these big, serial type shows, and Smallville hints at it, it's not one of those shows. It's a weekly show.
Right.
They're self-contained episodes, but there's nuggets in there that carry over throughout the entire season
right.
that really pay off. So, that can be frustrating for some people that, you know, would rather it be one thing or the other.
Well, and I think the thing with Smallville is that, like you said, there's nuggets. You're panning for gold. You have a lot of duds, you know. You have a lot of rocks. But every now and then, they'll give you something that is about the mythology of Superman. And it's the birth of something. You know, you'll see the first time he has heat vision. You know, you see the first time he discovers about his, you know, his super hearing. Mm-hmm. And you get to see him hone these talents, you know. Or you get to see him run into a superhero, like when he ran into the Flash, like we talked about. The young mm-hmm. Flash. You know, we got an episode where he ran into the young Aquaman. And really, those things were absolutely fantastic, geek-out, fanboy, you know, dorky moments for us. Because it would send you just, you know, you'd be so gleeful that you got that little nugget that it'd be worth the whole show.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's the thing that's strong, you know. Names involved. Tom Welling is Clark. Michael Rosenbaum is Lex, who, you know, is fantastic in the role. And, you know, John Schneider, Annette O'Toole, who had also been in Superman 3. And, of course, our favorite, John Glover.
Oh, yeah.
Who
yeah.
is really a strong addition to the canon of Superman as Lionel Luthor.
And, I mean, just his background, it opens up the mythology and the story of Lex Luthor so much. I mean, it's Lex is a great character, and he's even a better character when you know where it came from.
Right. So, absolutely. And I'm in love with Allison Mack as Chloe.
Mm, yeah.
Too stinking hot. And I don't know why Clark never got him a piece of that. But he had to mess with stupid Lana, who, you know, please kill her off already or do something. And we also had a young Lois Lane in there, too, who's got a great, you know, play with Clark. But it's more of a brother thing at this point.
Yeah, well, and I think by the time season 4 came around, the show needed a new dynamic.
Right.
Something fresh. And she brought that. And I thought that was good.
Yeah.
You know, much like when, spoiler alert, Chloe finally learns his secret.
Right.
The dynamic of the show could change, so it could at least be different than what we're used to seeing.
Right, absolutely. So, yeah, definitely had a few great seasons in it. I'm hoping this show gets back on track. I personally didn't like season 5. I know that you're about to get into it when they release the new DVD set. Mm-hmm. But, it's worth it for the nuggets, folks. It's definitely worth starting at the beginning and moving through it. If you love Superman, the mythology of Superman, it's absolutely one of the best presentations ever. And, you know, hey, you know, we talk about Superman in the Superman Returns review, but there's things in Smallville that geek us out even stronger than they did in Superman Returns. I was saying, in Superman Returns, if you could give us at least one moment that we had a strong geek out moment too, like we did in Smallville, we would have been happy. But
yeah,
really, it didn't have any of that kind of magic that we occasionally got in Smallville. But you'll have to listen to the Superman Returns review for that if you haven't already. All right, in 2002, Warner Brothers and DC, on the back of Smallville's success, decided they were going to do something with the Batman story on television. But they put a twist in there, and this was called Birds of Prey.
Legend tells of a caped crusader, Batman, guardian of New Gotham, and his one true love, Catwoman, the queen of the criminal underworld. Their passion left behind something extraordinary. A daughter, Huntress. Half metahuman, she has taken up her father's mantle and fights to protect the innocent and helpless. Joining her in this struggle, Oracle, once Batman's protege, Batgirl. She was caught in the crossfire of the war between Batman and Joker. Now she fights crime a different way. A master of the cyber realms and trainer to heroes. Together, they have taken in Dinah, a metahuman herself, with powers that she is only beginning to explore. These three are the protectors of New Gotham, the Birds of Prey.
And basically, you know, like you heard in the little audio intro there, is this is the daughter of Batman and Catwoman, and she's a metahuman, whatever that is. But she's got superpowers, and more than anything, when I look at this series, I never saw it. You know, I mean, it was here and gone. I don't even know how many episodes it had. But to me, the premise is extremely interesting. And I would like to get into this. You know, maybe I'm wrong, and maybe after seeing one episode, I'll go, ooh, you know, no thanks.
The people I talked to that watched the pilot were very underwhelmed.
Right.
Same kind of enthusiasm for the idea and the concept, but not for the final execution.
Right.
But I don't know. I never saw it. And maybe it's the kind of thing that you can't do it in the pilot. It takes a few episodes, you know, to get its feet. Remember, I mean, Smallville had a good pilot, you know, in its favor.
Right.
But it had some rocky episodes in season one.
Sure.
That you had to kind of get through that, you know, until it found its legs. So it can be difficult for a show like that of a specific genre, especially one that's trying to do something so new and different, like this Birds of Prey.
Well, and it could have been a show that was just so expensive. By the way it looked, it's got a real hard goth look to it, you know, real dark like the Batman movies, you know, the Burton movies, that maybe it was just so cost-effective that it had to be an immediate hit. I mean, the interesting thing is that it does go into some backlog with, you know, the main girl who leads the team. They become a team of the Huntress, who's the daughter, and then Batgirl, mm-hmm. who, you know, I guess gets shot by the Joker and is wheelchair bound. So she's the mentor now, and she teaches. And mm-hmm. then they pick up some other girl who can see the future or something. But they become this team. And the interesting thing, is that I know that we got some flashbacks that Batgirl fighting alongside Batman, which, you know, is very cool because you want to see some of that stuff, definitely. So, I don't know. I think this is something that interests me. I want to pick it up. Maybe it's terrible, you know, but at least the premise. I could see them sitting down and saying, what if we did this? And someone saying, yeah, that sounds very interesting. Mm-hmm. So,
maybe not for 22 episodes, but certainly for a good movie.
Right. And more than anything, I think they said, hey, let's put three hot chicks together and let them be superheroes and fight.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and that's definitely what they were going for because they are hot chicks. So... After all these mediums, and the place that we really want to go is straight into the world of cinema, into the world of films. And the place where superheroes started in films was in 1951 with Superman and the Mole Men.
You're not going to shoot those little creatures. In the first place, they haven't done you any harm. In the second place, they may be radioactive. If they fall in the reservoir, they may contaminate the water supply.
And this was the first time we would see George Reeves as Superman. And this was a full-length feature film. You know, they had done the series before with Kirk Allen, but George Reeves took over the role of Superman here, and it really became his. Because the success of this film would propel DC to make the Superman, the Adventures of Superman TV series, which was hugely successful, you know, as we previously talked about. But it was this movie, and like I said, you know, you have to mark it in history as the first feature-length film of a superhero, and, you know, appropriately enough, it was Superman.
Emergency. Batman speaking. Warning all of you to brace yourselves for big news.
The biggest.
Tell them, Robin.
Holy superlatives, Batman! It's really exciting. Soon, very soon, Batman and I will be batapulting right out of your TV sets and onto your theater screens.
That's right, Robin. Our first full-length motion picture feature in color opens a whole new world of thrills. The big screen gives us more space on land, sea, and in the air to challenge the most bataclysmic collection of super criminals that ever plotted to take over the world.
Holy memoranda, folks! Make a note not to miss it.
Good thinking, Robin.
The summer after the series came out, between season one and season two, we had the Batman the movie.
Right.
Which was in theaters. And, man, you know, it was basically the series, but to a, you know, a huge degree. And what it had originally been planned was that was going to actually be the pilot between the to start everything off.
Okay.
But it didn't work out, so they just did it between seasons one and seasons two. And that was great because we had all the criminal, you know, everyone came together.
Mm-hmm.
All the bad guys came together and everything was huge. And we had the bat boat and the bat copter and bat shark repellent.
Right.
Remember that shark hanging off Batman's leg?
Right.
In the bat copter and stuff? So, I just, I remember seeing the movie on TV and just, I was, you know, like, oh my God, you know, how cool is that? Mm-hmm. So, yeah.
Channel and 13 million dollar movie?
Yeah, exactly. Perfect. And that was exciting. That was fantastic. So anyways, in the late 1960s, Batman was huge.
This is Doc Savage, the Man of Bronze.
In 1975, though, and now this dude is kind of in the middle here, but and I know you've heard of Doc Savage. Mm-hmm. Now, this guy is a pulp comics character, okay? He's been in books, he's been in certain comics, and he actually appeared in both Marvel and DC, but he appeared in Golden Key comic books, Street and Smith, Curtis, Millennium, and even Dark Horse later on today. But in 1975, feature film, we get Doc Savage, Man of Bronze. Okay, this is directed by Michael Anderson, who we knew from Logan's Run and Orca. But Ron Ely played Doc Savage, and he had been Tarzan before from like 1966 to 1970, so he was pretty popular. But after Doc Savage, he just went on and became a game show host, and I think a lot of people remember him for that. But the movie was a real tongue-in-cheek comedy. And it was like, you know, Doc Savage had this team, you know, the Amazing Five, and they battled Captain C's and the Green Death. But anyways, it was a real campy movie. I remember seeing it in the theater. I think my dad took me to see it, and I loved it. I thought it was the best. But it was really campy, and seeing it on television years later, I remember it just being awful. But I have kind of that nostalgia for it. But that was that. And like I said, he was kind of an in-between man. So the first time we're really getting into a big superhero movie, they take him from pulp magazines instead of straight from DC or Marvel.
Do not remember me. I am Jor-El. I'm your father. By now you will have reached your 18th year, as it is measured on Earth. By that reckoning, I will have been dead for many thousands of your years. The knowledge that I have matters physical and historic. I've given you fully on your voyage to your new home. These are important matters, to be sure, but still matters of mere fact. There are questions to be asked, and it is time for you to do so. Here in this fortress of solitude, we shall try to find the answers together. So, my son, speak.
Who am I?
Your name is Kal-El. You are the only survivor of the planet Krypton. Even though you've been raised as a human being, you are not one of them. You have great powers, only some of which you have as yet discovered. Come with me now, my son, as we break through the bars of your earthly confinement, traveling through time and space.
In 1978, everything would change. And you know why. Because the Man of Steel was about to make his appearance on the silver screen.
Alexander and Ilya Salkin Now, they made a fortune off the Three Musketeer movie and the Four Musketeer. And what they basically did is they went out and made one big movie and chopped it in two and released it as two different movies, a movie and a sequel. Mm-hmm. But they filmed it all at the same time. Mm-hmm. And Richard Lester was the director of both of those films. And I think the idea was, is the Salkins saw the Superman property as very cheap, so they got it. And the first thing they did is they went to Marlon Brando and offered him a record amount of money. Mm-hmm. You know, almost $3 million for 10 days worth of work or something like that. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Just, you know, an extraordinary amount of cash for very little work. Right. But it also, it gave the product a prestige, you know. Marlon Brando as Jor-El. And then they went to Gene Hackman, who had won the Oscar for The Fringe Connection, mm-hmm. and they hired him to play Lex Luthor and paid him a lot of money. Mm-hmm. So they had secured two actors before they had a script, before they even had a director, and they made a big splash announcement at Cannes, you know, mm-hmm. Superman. Mm-hmm. And then they went to work on trying to find a director. And the first one was going to be Guy Hamilton, who directed several James Bond films, including mm-hmm. Goldfinger. Mm-hmm. But Hamilton was a tax exile from England and couldn't work in England where they were going to shoot the movies. Mm. So he was out, and they needed a director to fill in. And hot off his little hit, The Omen, mm-hmm. Richard Donner's phone rang, and he tells a story. I think he was on the toilet when he got the phone call from the Salkins, and they said they had Brando, they had Hackman, they had the shooting dates locked, and he was going to get paid $1 million.
Now, hello.
Which was a huge, huge sum for a director. And we're guessing this is right around 75, 76 when he got the phone call.
Right.
Or 77. And but then he told him it was going to be for two films.
Mm.
That they were actually going to shoot two films instead of one. And Mario Puzo had written a script. And David Leslie Newman had taken a pass on it and done some revisions. And it was sent to Donner. And it was huge.
Mm-hmm.
And Donner seemed to... his take on it was it was very campy. And its approach to telling Superman, to where, and very contemporary, it would be Superman would be on the street and he'd run into Telly Savalas and they would say, "Who loves you, baby?" before he would take off and fly away.
Oh, God.
You know, very referential, which was a very hip thing to do because remember, superheroes didn't get a lot of respect.
Right.
In the 70s.
Right.
And so they were very taken in that whole tongue-in-cheek way.
Sure.
But Donner threw it all out. He brought in writer Tom Mankiewicz, and they just completely recrafted it back to, you know, good old apple pie Americana.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And basically, he got to make three different movies out of it. You know, he got to do the Krypton opening, which was kind of mysterious, telling the backstory of Krypton. Mm-hmm. The middle chapter, which is growing up in Smallville kind of movie. Mm-hmm. Which is very, you know, Americana with the big widescreen vast shots
sure.
of the fields.
Some of the most powerful stuff I've ever seen, absolutely.
And all the Kansas scenery. And then the third one, which, you know, once it arrives in a metropolis, it's a really fun, mm-hmm. loose, good time kind of movie.
Yeah.
You know, it takes on a different kind of tone.
Yeah.
And it feels epic because it did take the trouble to tell all of this story. It wasn't in any hurry to get to the man in the suit.
The stuff in Smallville is just very powerful with, you know, Jonathan Kent's death.
Mm-hmm.
And I just remember, you know, the scene, you know, he's died and, you know, young Clark Kent is out in that field. And it just, the camera is on some kind of crane and it's sweeping through, you know what I mean? And the music's gorgeous and the sunset is going and you got the wheat fields, the corn fields or whatever. And the camera's just pulling back. And when you watch it, it's just so powerful because nobody takes that kind of time anymore, you know? And it was just contemplation, him saying, what's my next move? And I just, it's one of my most favorite scenes of any movie ever, you know, not just a superhero film, of him just contemplating, what's my next move? It's a big world, you know? I've got such a weight on my shoulders.
It's great because they do it without dialogue. It does what cinema does best.
Exactly.
It's images and music.
And it's just extremely powerful. And you nailed it. I mean, it really is three separate films, you know, each being, you know, powerful in their own right and a lot of fun. And so, and you know, many people still say today, this is the penultimate superhero film. You know, a lot of people have tried to say, wait a minute, what about Batman? Wait a minute, what about Spider-Man? But,
well,
you know, there's still something so grand and so huge to Superman the movie.
All those films owe a debt to Superman the movie.
Right.
And I mean, think about it. Here we are saying the movie. It also shows you the state of where superheroes were at that time and where Superman was. People had to be reminded that this wasn't that old TV show.
Right.
This was a brand new movie, you know, of Superman, unlike anything you'd seen before. I mean, the tagline was, "You'll believe a man can fly."
Right.
That's what they were selling. This was going to be the first time you were going to see realistic flying in a movie. And, you know, 77, 78 technology, movies had taken a huge jump, especially after Star Wars in 77.
Right.
But there was a lot of big, major productions that were leading up to something as large as Superman was. And the script was very smart in how it set up the three Phantom Zone villains, you know, that were going to play a part in its sequel. I mean, knowing that they were going out and shooting two films at the same time.
Right.
Was a great way to approach something this large. I mean, from my understanding, is Donner shot all of the Brando and all the Gene Hackman stuff first.
Right, and got rid
and
of
then,
them.
And got, you know, started shooting a lot of other sequences, and they started falling behind. So they decided to stop working on Superman 2 and just finish 1 and get it out in theaters. And once the money came in, then they would go and finish up number 2. But I guess he had a very strained relationship with the Salkins, and Donner wasn't speaking with them, and Richard Lester was brought in as a go-between to speak between the Salkins and Donner. And supposedly, Lester and Donner got along fabulously and communicated what they needed to communicate and got through the work.
Right.
And I think it was Lester's idea to have the plot point of Superman turning the world around and saving Lois brought up to the first film to give it a really powerful ending. As opposed to waiting till the end of Superman 2 to use it.
Right, right.
So he was definitely on board, and Donner got to make his film. It premiered Christmas 78 and was immediately a smash success.
Yep, absolutely.
And the first thing the Salkins did was call up and fire Richard Donner.
Yeah, you're out.
We don't need you anymore. Thank you.
Yeah.
And at that time, Lester was brought in to finish shooting Superman 2. And to get that film, and, you know, I know Christopher Reeve and Margot Kidder and much of the cast, you know, were very loyal to Richard Donner, but they were under contract, of course, to finish up the movies. And Lester brings a different type of energy. Lester isn't going to be interested in the same type of Americana that Richard Donner is. I mean, Richard Lester is an Englishman. He's not an American. But he's certainly a capable director. But I don't know if the Superman superhero genre is the right genre for someone of Richard Lester's talents.
Right.
I mean, I think, you know, Superman 2 was brought in, and Gene Hackman refused to come back and shoot any more scenes, so they had a stunt double for him, and they shot a lot of long shots, and they had someone come in doing voiceovers as the Lex Luthor character. I mean, when you look back at Superman 2, it was very patchwork and how it was put together in terms of a movie. And here we are now in 2006. There's a rumor that Richard Donner is finally going to put together his version of Superman 2 with a lot of footage that he shot that was never even used for the theatrical version that eventually came out.
Well, you know what? And I'm all for that. That would be a great and exciting thing to see. Although I kind of hope he does some George Lucas work on Superman the movie and just kills the whole Lois Lane flying. Can you read my mind scene?
Can you read my mind? Do you know what it is that you do to me? I don't know who you are. Just a friend from another star.
Well, you could easily lose it, and you know you wouldn't hurt anything in the movie.
Well, no. I mean, let's be honest. In a great movie, it is a horrible, just sticking out point, and I hate it. And I had read that she originally was supposed to sing it, but that her singing voice was so bad that they killed it, and they just had her read it. And her reading on it is so awful. It doesn't have any place in the movie at all. And I don't understand how it happened, why it happened. I guess I need to listen to a commentary or something somewhere to figure it out. But it's just, to me, it's an atrocity right in the middle of this great movie, and it just kills me.
Well, for people that didn't live through the era, there was a phenomenon in the 70s called the variety show.
Yeah.
Singing and performing was very popular.
Yeah.
And it was popular to have sequences like that in a movie.
Yeah.
To where you would just sort of, you know, having musical song type sequence.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it is pretty horrible.
Here I am, like a kid out of school, holding hands with a god. I'm a fool. You look at me, quivering, like a little girl, shivering. You can see right through me.
We interrupt this program for an urgent message from the President of the United States.
This is your president. On behalf of my country, and in the name of the other leaders of the world, with whom I have today consulted, I hereby abdicate all authority and control over this planet to General Zod.
Zod.
Only by strict compliance with all his directions will the lives of innocent millions be spared. Superman, can you hear me? Superman, where?
Who is this Superman?
You'll find out, General, and when you do...
Come to me, Superman, if you dare. I defy you! Come! Come and kneel before Zod! Zod!
We're moving into the 80s now, okay? And 1980, of course, we go to Superman 2. And we've talked about it a little bit, but obviously Superman is continuing his reign, and DC's not doing a whole bunch more but Superman at this point. You know, everything's based on Superman. It was a huge hit. Richard Lester, we talked about it. We really don't. You have anything else you want to say about Superman 2?
Well, it did come out in Europe before it came out in the United States. That's kind of interesting.
I didn't know that.
They showed it in Christmas 80, I believe, in Europe, and we got it summer 81, the same summer as Raiders of the Lost Ark and Cannonball Run.
Oh, wow, cool.
But, yeah, I mean, when you watch the credits of Superman, it says, you know, next year, Superman 2.
Mm.
So they were supposed to have that thing out, you know, ready for 79.
Right.
But delays, you know, kept it and, you know, eventually came out in Europe in 80 and we got in 81. It was a huge hit.
Right.
Monstrous hit, you know, and I saw it several times in the theater.
Sure.
For sure. And loved it quite a bit and just couldn't wait for Superman 3 by that point.
Sure.
Come to me, son of Jor-El! Kneel before Zod!
Government agents. Scientists. Soldiers. Master criminals. Secret formulas. Monsters and midgets. None of them belong in this swamp. Only one thing does. The Swamp Thing. Adrienne Barbeau and the Swamp Thing. An outrageous pair. In the incredible adventure that grows on you. Or all over you. The Adventures of the Swamp Thing. The comic book legend lives.
Continuing down the timeline, 1982, we get a little film called Swamp Thing.
Wes Craven.
Wes Craven. And Adrienne Barbeau.
Famous movie for her nudity scenes.
Yeah, and we all remember her from Escape from New York, The Fog, Cannonball Run. But, oh man, she was a bombshell back then. And I remember there was always posters of her and everything. But, yeah, Swamp Thing. Very campy, very kind of fun. I remember seeing it somewhere. I don't remember. Maybe a Dollar Cinema or something.
Mm-hmm.
But I saw it. And it's weird. You know, how is Swamp Thing a hero? I don't know. I mean, I guess you could say the same thing about the Hulk. But anyways, that was 1982.
When it's time for adventure... It's time for Superman. Alexander Salkind presents Christopher Reeve and Richard Pryor in Superman 3. This time, Richard Pryor has come to Metropolis.
Oh, I'm sorry.
And he's got something to sell. He's the best con man and the world's greatest computer genius.
Let me tell you something. I can't ski.
But then he falls for a scheme to turn the ultimate computer into the ultimate weapon.
All right, Webster, the game's over.
But only the man who pulled the switch on Superman.
Oh, see, I'm not with them, Superman.
Could have fooled me, mister.
Can pull the plug on Super Machine.
You're going to go down in history as the man who killed Superman.
No. Thank you, brother.
Superman 3.
Watch the trees. Whoa!
This time is going to be the best time of all.
Okay, Richard Lester is back. But guess what? Someone needs to put Richard Pryor in a movie.
Well, and it's just, it's one of those movies that's conceived of for all the wrong reasons.
Yes.
I mean, the Salkins went and brought back in David and Leslie Newman, who had wrote the campy version that Donna rejected.
Mm-hmm.
And they finally got to do their version of Superman, which was very campy and very, you know, jokey and funny. Mm-hmm. I mean, the opening sequence of Superman 3 is a brilliantly executed sequence of hijinks, perfect for someone of Richard Lester's talents.
Right.
But does it really belong in a Superman movie?
Mm-hmm.
That's what you have to ask, you know. I mean, it's very creative on how they, you know, have the credits sort of fly in a very unique way. But it is strange. The tone of the film is very different. But the fact that they felt the need, that they needed a huge star like Richard Pryor to carry this movie, that the Superman imprint wasn't enough, just shows you how misguided the people who owned this property were about what they had.
Do you remember the poster with Superman carrying Richard Pryor?
Yeah.
Oh, it's just so awful.
I mean, they just... It's hard to believe that, you know, after the first two movies, they had nowhere to go. I mean, they just virtually ignored all of the rich history in the comic books and came up with, what's popular right now? Mm-hmm. Video games are popular, and so is Richard Pryor.
Yeah.
So let's come up with something that can combine both of them.
Right.
I mean, the supercomputer he goes up against, you know, and it's just... you know.
Well, but we did get to see... We did get to see Annette O'Toole as Lana Lang.
Well, the Smallville portions of the film are not bad,
actually.
You know, it is kind of nice, you know, seeing them go back and experience that side of Clark Kent, because I do like Christopher Reeve's Clark Kent performance.
Sure.
And it is a lot of fun, the influence he has on Lana's child.
Well, and it's fun seeing... It's fun now, being a Smallville fan, seeing, you know, Annette O'Toole now as Martha Kent, you know, back in that history where she was Lana Lang. But, you know, that's always been one of our favorite things about Smallville was their connections to the original Superman series.
But I was so disappointed.
Yeah.
I saw Superman 3.
Yeah, and it did not do well. And it was just because it was just a bad movie. I mean, it just was not... I mean, Superman wasn't even in it that much, to be honest with you. It was Gus Gorman.
It wasn't a good script. I mean, they weren't going to make a good movie out of that script, no matter how they approached it.
Right.
So. I mean, the focus was completely, you know, misguided.
Mm-hmm.
And it's too bad, because that was a huge moneymaker franchise.
Right.
And because Superman 3 did as poor and was, you know, received as poorly, the Salkins just went garage sale.
Came halfway across the universe on a mission to save her world.
Who is she?
From the producers of Superman, Alexander Salkind presents Supergirl in her first great adventure.
Wait a minute, wait one minute. I mean, you can do the whole number, leap tall buildings with a single bound?
Yes.
Like Superman.
He's my cousin.
Whoa.
Supergirl, on a secret quest that brings her face to face with diabolical villains.
I am considering nothing less than world domination.
Unspeakable evil.
You've had your fun, Selena. The game is finished.
Starring Faye Dunaway, Peter O'Toole, Peter Cook, Brenda Vaccaro, Mark McClure, Hart Buckner, and introducing Helen Slater as Supergirl.
What happened next, the next year, was that they decided to make a Superman movie without Superman.
Right, they did the Supergirl, right?
So they did Supergirl in 1984. Jeanne Schwartz, with Helen Slater as Kara / Supergirl, Faye Dunaway, Peter O'Toole, Mia Farrow were all in there. And, I don't even know why this movie happened. And I've seen it once, but it's been... I have barely any memory of it.
Well, I'm sure the reason it happened was is after Superman 2 made so much money, the Salkins were probably thinking, okay, we need to hedge our bets.
Right.
We're going to get Superman 3 ready and Supergirl ready for the very next year.
Mm-hmm.
So we'll hit them with the 1-2 punch, 83 and 84,
mm-hmm.
with, two super movies. But, again,
Yeah, and I mean...
Santa Claus, the movie, would be coming right afterwards.
Yeah.
So it tells you the direction that they were really thinking.
So, and like I said, I don't have a lot of memory of the movie. I know that, it didn't do that well. And, to me, what always amazed me was, okay, so Supergirl shows up and Superman and Supergirl can both fly really fast, and yet Superman never pays a visit.
Oh, I know. That's the hard thing about... You cannot do a Supergirl movie without Superman.
Right.
You need his presence in there of acknowledgement. It's just... It's too weird of a different universe.
Yeah. It's like what? He was too busy at the Daily Planet to stop by his cousin and maybe help her out a little bit. You know what I mean? Just anything. Come on.
And I don't know what Christopher Reeve's relationship was like with the Salkins, and maybe he wasn't contracted, and maybe he didn't have to do it, and maybe he didn't want to do it.
Well, I read that there was a cameo planned, but at the end, Christopher Reeve said, nah.
Okay.
So, and that's too bad, because we
wanted... But after Superman 3, he needed to maybe try and move away from Superman.
Right. Because
it wasn't going to, continue on in a good way with the way it was being handled. But that's what I understand is the Salkins, sold all the rights of how they figured out all their flying rig, and they sold all the rights to Superman to Canon.
Right, and that's coming up pretty soon. Mm-hmm. But check this out real quick, and I thought this was very interesting, was the movie was completed by copyright holder Warner Brothers. However, due to chaos from Superman 3, Warners decided to drop the film and keep it on the shelf. Later, the then-fledging TriStar Pictures picked it up and cut it down to a viewing time of 105 minutes from 126 minutes.
Hmm.
So there was a longer film out there, and I know that they had made a two-disc set that's like out of print now.
Yeah, it is the extended cut of the film.
Yeah.
You can get it.
International version. Extended 125-minute international version, but then disc 2 is the never-before-seen 140-minute version with extra footage.
Right.
Now, I don't know that extra footage is going to help, poor Kara out that much, but... I don't know. And I went and looked on eBay, and you got to pay like $60 to get this thing now. So I think I'll pass.
The greatest hope against the threat of nuclear war is Superman.
I'm going to do what our governments have been unwilling or unable to do. Effective immediately, I'm going to rid our planet of all nuclear weapons.
The greatest threat to Superman is Lex Luthor.
Smarter than I thought. We can make the world safe for war profits.
He's created the ultimate weapon to annihilate the Man of Steel.
You'd risk worldwide nuclear war for your own personal financial gain.
Nobody wants war. I just want to keep the threat alive.
Dude of Steel. Where are you gonna get it?
You know you're a workaholic. Let's just stop and smell the roses, huh?
Superman 4. Christopher Reeve, Gene Hackman, Jackie Cooper, John Cryer, with Mariel Hemingway and Margot Kidder as Lois Lane. Superman 4. His most important adventure.
the quest for peace.
In 1987, we're going to go to the absolute bottom of the barrel here. And you had said earlier that, you know, Superman got, you know, garage sailed off to canon. And we all know about canon.
Well, from what I understand, Superman 4 had earnest beginnings.
Right.
The only way they could get Reeve back was to give him control over the story.
Mm-hmm.
So they got that. And, you know, Reeve got together with a couple of guys and they worked up a screenplay that they thought was going to be more in the spirit of the second film as mm-hmm. opposed to the third film. And then who are they going to get to direct? Well, fresh off his hot new little hit, Iron Eagle, they got Sidney J. Fury to come in. And he had never done a film of this size and scope before. But, mm-hmm. you know, he was available, he was interested, and he took the job. Before they started shooting, I think canon, they were budgeted at something around $35
million. Yeah, $36 million.
They cut $15 million out of the budget.
They set it down to $17 million just overnight.
Mm-hmm. Jeez, you know, right before they started shooting.
Yeah.
And that was my first impression of seeing the film in the theater the first day it came out, was how cheap it looked.
Yeah.
How cheap the credits looked, you know, mm-hmm. and just how all the special effects somehow did not look as good as the other films. And my impression was, is always the effects got better as films went along, because right. you know, that's how I was accustomed to it, you know,
right,
not going backwards like that.
Well, it's,
and from what I understand, there was a version of the film that was test screened in San Jose that was about 35 minutes longer, mm-hmm. 135 minute cut, and it was received so poorly they chopped it down to 90 minutes and just threw it out in the cinemas the same day as Jaws the Revenge.
Man, that's too bad. And I just remember it being a bomb. And what I can't imagine is, how do they talk Gene Hackman back into this?
Money.
You know?
Money talks.
Yeah.
Hackman got paid.
Yeah.
And then it just also shows you, again, that sort of studio line thinking is, okay, it's not enough that we get Lex Luthor back. Okay. Mm. We need a sidekick, a hot young actor who's hot. Let's get that guy who played Ducky in Pretty in Pink, you know?
John Cryer.
Let's just throw him in there,
yeah.
you know? And we'll give him some wacky stuff to do,
uh-huh,
you know?
Uh-huh.
Because kids will like that, you know?
Yeah.
It's just, it's moronic how these decisions yeah. are made that affect
what
movies.
Happened? Let's have Ned Beatty back. Come on. You know, I mean, but, yeah, we had Mariel Hemingway, which was nice because she was gorgeous. But, you know, this, I have to admit, though, that this film did have one bright point, and that was the interdiction of Mark Pello, you know, the guy who played Nuclear Man. Mm-hmm. His first and only movie ever. I wonder why.
I guess
Nuclear Man.
Him and Aqua Tool can go do a film together.
Yeah, acting brilliance. So yeah, let's put that one away. And you know, I think the saddest thing of all was that, you know, it was that Christopher Reeve and Cannon were going to give us a lesson on nuclear weapons. You know what I mean? Superman was going to save us all by ridding the whole world of nuclear weapons. Thanks, Supes. You know what I mean? So yeah, that really, I mean, and one good thing that came out of that also, besides, you know, Mark Pello, was, I got a note here, it says, the failure of this film at the box office prompted the Canon Group to cancel a planned production of Spider-Man.
Mm-hmm.
Thank God.
That's probably the best thing that could have happened.
Exactly.
You know, they were ready to go do their cheapy version. They bought the rights. I mean, Canon was basically thinking, okay, these superhero movies, you know, have been, you know, no one wants them anymore, but there is a value to it, you
right,
know.
Right.
We can certainly, you know, produce some quickie films and make a buck.
The big green guy is back.
They call me Swamp Thing.
You're a plant, aren't you?
He's come back to settle a score.
Find him. Bring him in.
He's got a grudge, cause they turned him to sludge.
I believe this is yours.
What?
The return of Swamp Thing. Starring Louis Jordan.
What did you do? Sell your soul to the devil?
Let's just say he has a lease with an option to buy.
Heather Locklear.
She can get in my veins in time to most things.
Why can't men do more like plants? I mean, you can stroke a plant and it doesn't get the wrong idea.
And Swamp Thing.
But I can't give you the kind of love you want.
Why not?
I'm a plant.
That's okay. I'm a vegetarian.
The return of Swamp Thing. He's turning over a new leaf for love.
1989, we're looking at the return of Swamp Thing. And so what? You know what I mean? Who cares? Why this happened, I don't know. Directed by Jim Wynarski, his name was, and he had directed such big movies as Ghoulies 4. So, you know, I'm sure that was a great hit. Heather Locklear was in it, but easily forgettable. Funny thing is that its tagline was, America's favorite superhero is back in action. Boy, I didn't know that Super Swamp Thing was the America's favorite. But
he was that one week it came out, I guess, right? In the first movie?
Don't kill me. Don't kill me, man. Don't kill me. Don't kill me, man.
I'm not going to kill you. I want you to do me a favor. I want you to tell all your friends about me.
What are you?
I'm Batman.
'89 was a massive, huge year because 1989 was to the 80s when 1978 was to the 70s because that's when DC dropped Batman.
They've been trying to make Batman for a lot of years, mm-hmm. at least since 79 or 80, right? I mean, this was a long, long road to get this film made.
So, yeah, and in 1989, we finally got the return of Batman, his first serious outing. If you can call, you know, Tim Burton's Batman serious.
If you can call it that.
If you can call it that. It was definitely, you know, a lot more serious than the Adam West Batman.
Well, certainly more than what we were used to at the time.
Right.
You know, and right. you know, it certainly served to change the way we looked at Batman when right. we only had the TV show before.
Right.
And so, it is funny that, you know, everybody went ballistic when they found out that Michael Keaton had been cast.
Yeah.
As Batman. You kind of have to remember the hysteria that went on.
Right, I remember that.
And a lot of Batman fans were outraged mm-hmm. by that decision.
Yeah.
Which, it seems to me, it's really kind of odd, but I see the brilliance in the choice of Keaton right off the bat because you're not casting Batman. You're casting Bruce Wayne.
Right.
And that's the key role you have to cast first. Because mm-hmm. eventually it's a guy in a suit, ultimately. You know, when you play the Batman side.
Right.
And most all the actors that have donned the Batman suit have done fine in the suit.
Right.
But it's the Bruce Wayne that defines how well, you know, they're going to be as the character. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And I think Keaton had a good choice. There was a certain look to him. Mm-hmm. It was just a little bit off that made him a good choice.
Right. And, of course, the big villain was going to be Joker.
Ever dance with the devil in the pale moonlight? What? I always ask that of all my prey.
And we know that was, you know, Jack Nicholson who stepped into that role, and that was just, that made this thing go from one level to just monstrous levels.
Well, you got John Peters and Pooter Goober producing it, and they did the same thing the Salkins did. They admitted, we don't know anything about Batman, but, you know, we're going to hire people that do, and we're just going to give Jack Nicholson, one of the biggest stars in the world,
right?
You know, a lot of money to play the Joker. Well, that's mm-hmm, going to give us mm-hmm. legitimacy right off the bat.
Love that Joker.
You know, and I had heard in my note here, I have Jack Nicholson received a percentage of the gross of the film, and due to its massive box office, took home around $60
million. Right.
And as of 2003, it's still the highest single movie record for an actor's salary.
Wow.
$60 million. Smart move, you know. Take the back end, you know, instead of just, you know, one fat paycheck.
I'd heard that he even made money off Batman Returns even though he didn't have anything to do with it, just because of the deal from Batman.
Right. Hey, can't beat that. But anyways, it was a cultural phenomenon at the time. You know, it really had exist. People had remembered Superman, but this was this decade's next film, and it was massive. And everything was covered in Batman logos, T-shirts, merchandising was out the nose. And I read that it had made like about $750 million in merchandising alone.
I mean, so much so they had to add Prince to the soundtrack to cross market it.
Yeah, well, we had to have our soundtrack out there. There was two soundtracks, and that was uncommon for the time. You know what I mean? You know, we had our regular Danny Elfman score, which was a very thematic score, and but then we also had all those Prince songs, which were big hits in themselves. So. Man.
Well, it's just you had MTV promoting it all day long.
Right.
You know, it's just they were covering all their multimedia outlets to help sell this film.
Right. So, yeah, at the time, it was a massive thing. And, God, what else can we say about it? I'm sure most everyone who's listened to this show remembers all that and probably still has some kind of Batman paraphernalia in their house because, I mean, it was like Star Wars almost.
Except it wasn't all that good.
Yeah. Well, see, and that's the thing. And this is a very interesting, because you and I talked about this, is that I think there's this idea that people are always saying, oh yeah, Batman's the best superhero movie of all time. And I think it's just kind of this default that people go to, oh yeah, Batman. Put Batman in there. If you're talking the best superhero movies ever, you got to throw Batman in there. Is that really true?
I don't know. There's just that when I draw up the line about the good things in it and the bad things in it, they really... So many of them cancel each other out.
Right.
I mean, obviously the good things are Nicholson and his portrayal of Joker. That's a lot of fun to watch.
Right.
And Keaton is good too, but the movie's just as much about Robert Rule, the reporter, and the Kim Basinger character as it is Bruce Wayne.
Yeah.
They, in fact, get more screen time than Bruce Wayne does. And I find that annoying because I don't see how that helps a movie called Batman a great deal.
Yeah, and Robert Wool's character, even though he's kind of funny, I mean, pointless. Absolutely. And, yeah, I don't get it.
I mean, and I just... So I don't think that helps out the film, all that much. So I don't know. I mean, I just... I think they don't... They really botched the origin story or, recreate it in that sense. And I don't know why it had to be Joker that killed his parents.
Yeah.
Just to tie that in. And plus, they kill off Joker at the end. I mean, there's just sort of this, one-off attitude where, okay, we're going to fight the Joker will die, and there'll be no more Joker.
Yeah.
You're going to fight the Penguin will die, there'll be no more Penguin.
Right.
I don't know. I mean, I think the first film was okay. I did not like the Prince songs. I didn't think they really helped the film. Mm-hmm. I think as Prince songs, they're just fine. Mm-hmm. But I much preferred the Danny Elfman score in the movie. As opposed to the Prince.
Well, and I'm with you. I'm with you. I liked the film just fine. I didn't go gaga over it. I remember one thing I hated, and I'm so used to Indiana Jones punches. You know that big. When you hit somebody in the face and. God, I just remember that scene in the top of with the bell and everything, and just hearing this thud when they hit each other. I mean, just the worst sound effects I remember. It's like, come on, give me some in there, not this whatever this is. So. Yeah, it was like nothing. It was like, hitting a dead fish. It just, maybe that's a more realistic sound, but don't give me realistic. You already got a guy who's, can fly around on ropes and stuff. And
well, then, Joker pulls out this big old gun, one shot, and that plane is down.
Yeah.
Okay, maybe it could happen,
But that can happen, but we can't have, Indiana Jones, punch sounds. So.
No.
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, it's all right. I think the main thing is that at the time, it was a huge phenomenon.
Well, they got it made, and that was the big thing. They got Batman to the big screen, and that was the big battle.
Right.
And it had taken a lot of years, and a lot of different people had worked on it, and they finally had succeeded. And it turned into the massive kind of hit. I mean, it was Warner Brothers' biggest hit ever.
Right.
Revitalized the studio in a lot of ways. And God, it made kings out of Peter Guber and John Peters.
Yeah.
To the point where Sony paid them a whole lot of money to come over and run their studio.
Yeah.
Just because of the success of Batman.
The direct approach. I admire that in a man with a mask. You don't really think you'll win, do you?
Things change.
Meow.
I remember really liking Batman Returns when it came out, liking it more than the first one, because it felt very real and adult and not made for kids.
Right.
I loved Danny Elfman's score. I mean, you know, his second take on that theme and that material, I thought was just some of his best.
Yeah.
I thought the Catwoman-Batman relationship was probably, you know, a series best.
Great.
In terms of material that they were mining. The Penguin was creepy. He disturbed me. And it was, you know, I thought a strong choice to go to make the film so dark and unappealing. Now, there's some ridiculous things in it, too. It's an uneven film. And I think by the end, it kind of crashes under its own sort of Burton circus vaudeville, you know, strapping missiles onto onto all the marching penguins and everything.
Yeah.
You know, it gets kind of wild and outlandish.
Yeah, yeah.
But there's a lot of heart in with Michael Keaton and Michelle Pfeiffer and what they're doing with their Bruce Wayne, Selina Kyle personas.
Well, to me, that was the best part of the whole movie, you know, besides Michelle Pfeiffer's smoking outfit, you know what I mean, which has still got to be possibly one of the best superhero / supervillainess outfits ever. You know, if not the hottest ever.
And we got to see how she made it, which I always really liked, is it took care with her origin story. It showed her taking out some garment and cutting it up and sewing her costume together. I mean, you know, I mean, it was kind of nice, too, in Batman Returns. We got to see, you know, Batman getting dressed, or he'd have like he'd open up a cabinet or a safe, and there would be like two or three versions of his costume in there.
Right.
You know. Those just little touches, you know.
Mm-hmm.
I remember I always liked the one, too, where he was kind of sitting there pulling one of her claws out of his side.
Yeah.
Just sort of sighing, and it was just like a very real superhero moment.
Right.
He's in pain, you know. So there's a lot of things I thought in Batman Returns that were better. And it gave me, I mean, I thought it was an imperfect film. But there was a lot of things that I thought, you know, bode well for the franchise.
Yeah.
And if it was to keep going in this direction, I thought it could get very interesting.
Yeah.
Well, of course, once again, I'm in the minority.
Well, but I had a hard time because I was okay with that one. And I liked this one. I wasn't in love with this one. But I definitely think it was, like you said, more adult, more dark. You had mentioned something which was interesting. But I have it in the notes here. It says, in the U.S., McDonald's were forced to cancel a Happy Meal promotion with the film after parents protested about its violence and sexual nature being inappropriate for young children.
Well, if anybody ever wants to know why the series got all the way to where Batman and Robin ended up, this is the reason. It's because of Happy Meals. McDonald's was not happy, and a lot of kids and parents were complaining about the Penguin.
Right.
And the imagery on their cups and Happy Meals. And obviously Batman Returns, I mean, they sold it to the hilt, you know.
Right.
This was the sequel to Warner Brothers' biggest movie, you know.
Mm-hmm.
They were going to go to every available merchandising effect out there. And there was some backlash because Tim Burton wasn't giving them that film. You know, they basically let him go out and make any movie he wanted.
Right.
They wanted a sequel so badly. And he didn't give them necessarily the best Happy Meal movie
right.
that they could get. And because of that, they wanted to get rid of Tim Burton immediately. Uh-huh. They wanted him off the franchise. And you would see a lot of changes being made because Warner's was scared because obviously Batman Returns didn't make as much as the first one.
Right.
But, I mean, come on. It was the first one was one of those rare phenomena. It wasn't going to.
Everything's always got to top the previous, so... You know, so one interesting thing that I had read, and I don't know if this is true or not, but it says that this was the first film made in Dolby Digital.
Oh, I didn't know that.
Yeah, so I don't know. That's, you know, that's Internet Movie Database stuff, but, you know, anyways. But yeah, Batman Returns, another big movie, but definitely, you know, things were about to change for the Batman series.
What's that stand for?
Robin. Riddler and Two-Face can make a pretty lethal combination. Figured you could use a hand.
Two against two are better odds.
I can't promise I won't kill Harvey.
A man's gotta go his own way. A friend taught me that.
Not just a friend.
A partner.
Here comes Batman again. Now, DC at this point is completely geared on Batman. They're not doing anything else. It's Batman only. So in 1995, Joel Schumacher comes onto the scene because Tim Burton's out now. He's out.
He's on as producer.
Okay, he's on as producer.
It's a Tim Burton production of a Joel Schumacher film.
Okay.
Yeah, and you know, you got to remember Schumacher had done some hits for the studio. He's been a journeyman in Hollywood for years,
mm-hmm.
you know, going from stuff like, you know, writing Car Wash to directing The Incredible Shrieking Woman to writing and directing DC Cab, you know, to making St. Elmo's Fire. And yeah. I think he did, what was it, A Time to Kill, you know?
Yeah, Time to Kill.
And The Client, you know, the Grisham. So they were ready to hand Warner's the biggest franchise they had.
Yeah.
They're ready to give it to old Schumacher.
And he took it. And, you know, got a huge nemesis in there at the time, Jim Carrey. He was, you know, just becoming a huge star.
Riddle me this, riddle me that. Who's afraid of the big black bat?
Tommy Lee Jones is Two-Face. Now we got a new Batman coming in because Keaton said, no, thank you.
Mm-hmm.
And so Val Kilmer's in there.
It's the car, right? Chicks love the car.
It was a very different type of a Batman. You know, a blonde Bruce Wayne, which was kind of different. Nicole Kidman, Chris O'Donnell got entered into the story. This was Robin's origin story.
Fully rusted metal, Batman!
Huh?
You're grown, it's all metal, it's full of holes, you know? Holy!
And to me personally, I enjoyed this film. And for a while, and you know, it's probably the one that I enjoyed the most out of the first four Batman films, and I don't know why. I think that it's just I don't know that the darkness in it before didn't really work for me in the previous films, but for this, to me, this was the biggest one. It was the loudest one. I enjoyed it just on a certain action type comic book fun level, and so. But it was what it was, you know?
Yeah, I'm kind of mixed on it. There's some things in it I like. I think Kilmer, again, he's fine in the suit. I'm not wild about his Bruce Wayne.
Mm.
He doesn't look all that conflicted,
mm-hmm.
you know? And I don't really buy into his Bruce Wayne side of things.
No.
I like the way they handled the Robin origin story. I think that was handled pretty good.
Mm-hmm.
And the Riddler, I think, for the most part, is well dealt with.
Yeah.
Not a big fan of Tommy Lee Jones' Two-Face.
Two-Face.
It's a hammy performance. And it's almost like, you know, Tommy Lee Jones looks around and sees everybody else is at 10, so he's got to go to 12, you know, or something.
Right.
And I don't know. I just think they could have dealt with the character of Two-Face a lot better than just trying to cram him into the plot of this movie.
Yeah.
But, you know, I mean, the film was successful. I think it made about, what, 20 or 30 million more than Batman Returns did. Yeah. McDonald's was happy with the Happy Meals. The toys were selling. So Warner Brothers was happy, right?
You know, I know the one funny thing about this whole thing was that everyone made such a big fit about the whole nipples on the bat costumes.
Mm-hmm.
You remember that uproar? And so it was just like, oh, whatever. You know what I mean? I didn't even really care. But it was pretty silly. But it was enough to bother Bob Kane. But, you know, Schumacher wanted to have this kind of anatomic look to it. But, you know, he brought his image to it, and it did well. And everyone was happy. You know, I don't know how, you know, what the general fan, deep Batman fan was reaction was to it. But I know that financially it did well. And so they were hopping and ready to jump on to do another Batman movie.
Well, they thought they had, okay, our franchise is back. We just grossed more than the second. Let's James Bond this thing now to 2 years instead of waiting three.
Right.
Let's get this thing going. We want Batman.
It might be a little dangerous.
I laugh at danger.
I boogie around danger like a soul-trained dancer.
With a will of iron, a heart of gold, and a body of steel.
It's hammer time.
What a magnetic personality.
We gotta admit, the guy's got style.
Shaquille O'Neal.
Ready, go.
The Batcave.
Steel.
Man, I could be Robin.
You wanna know what you can do to help?
What? Anything.
Don't tell Grandma.
1997, DC. Now, this is a very interesting film. I haven't seen it, and probably no one has seen this movie. Steel.
Right.
Okay. Right. Directed by Kenneth Johnson, who had done a lot of TV, Hulk, Bionic Woman. He created V. He did the TV version of Alien Nation. But Shaquille O'Neal. It's very strange because obviously Steel has some sort of a connection to Superman.
Well, wasn't that after the death of Superman?
Yeah, yeah. But the plot in this, there was a guy named, he's John Henry Irons, okay? And he designs weapons for the military, you know? Shaq, obviously, yeah. He didn't play basketball at seven whatever. But he makes weapons for the military. But when his project to create weapons that harmlessly neutralize soldiers is sabotaged, he leaves in disgust. When he sees gangs are using his weapons on the street, he uses his brains and his Uncle Joe's junkyard know-how to fight back, becoming a real man of steel. So this is really a vigilante show, and the film had nothing to do with the comic. In the comic book, it says, Steel is a DC comic character. In the comic book, he was directly inspired by Superman when the Man of Steel saved his life, both literally and metaphorically. Since then, John Henry Irons sports Superman's shield as an homage to Kal-El. In the movie, the existence or not of Superman is not touched on. But John is related to the last son of Krypton via his tattoo. So I guess Shaq has a Superman tattoo. But that's a strange thing. That was a cheapie. And I think with me, I had never seen it. And I think the most important thing was is I just wanted to know, how does Superman tie in into all this? And obviously, there is a story with the death of Superman. But, you know, someone out there who knows about how that all fits together with the death of Superman, send me an email.
Welcome home, Frostface.
You're the common cold, and we're the cure.
Allow me to break the ice. My name is Freeze. Learn it well, for it's the chilling sound of your doom.
1997 was another very important year, because at this point, what was going to happen was that you were going to see the complete death of a franchise. Okay? And you know what I'm talking about. It's a little film called Batman and Robin. Directed by Joel Schumacher again. George Clooney takes over the role as Batman.
I mean, they got the same team from forever. They got the same writer. Akiva Goldsmith wrote Forever. They got him to write Batman and Robin. Same producer, same director, same everything. Cinematographer. The whole team just came over.
Well, basically, yeah, and that's what they did. They just went from one to the next. It was almost like a twofer. It was such a quick turnover. And, you know, from watching some of the behind the scenes on this film in the newest set, you know, the interesting thing is that Schumacher in the documentary on Batman and Robin talks about, yes, I am responsible.
The merchandising and licensing became a very, very important part of the making of the film. But I also have to say, I was an adult, I was awake, and I went along with it. So I'm not pointing a finger at anyone else and saying, they made me do this, all right? I was there.
What he said was, he learned a new word on this film, and it was called toyrific. They wanted Batman and Robin to be toyrific. And so, as so much into the fact that they wanted toy makers to be involved in the conception process for you know, the new Batmobile, the Robin's motor scooter, and all that stuff. What can you say about this movie?
It's loud. It's obnoxious.
It's just the excess of everything in this film, just blowing it up. I mean, this is really the movie version of the 1966 TV series. It's just camp all the way. It's just silly.
I mean, I knew it was all over. Well, it's kind of, you can tell earlier on, but there's a moment where Batman and Robin are arguing over Poison Ivy, bidding mm-hmm. on her, and mm-hmm. Batman whips out an American Express card,
yeah.
and it says Batman on it.
$2 million.
You don't have it.
$3 million. I'll borrow it from you. $4 million.
$5 million.
That's a utility belt, not a money belt. $6 million.
$7 million. Never leave the cave without it.
It's like, no, it's done. It's
yeah.
over.
It's over.
Put a nail in it. You've destroyed everything that was interesting and pure and good about Batman.
Definitely. And it is considered by some to be the worst superhero movie of all time.
It's, and I mean, and Clooney just, he's not a very strong Bruce Wayne in the film.
Remember the first time we saw the trailer? Hello, Freeze. I'm Batman. It was like,
I'm Darkman.
It was bad. It was like,
his costume looked bad. I mean, it just, I don't know. It's just, it seems like a screenplay that was just put together by the numbers, mm-hmm. you know. Mm-hmm. There's really not a lot to say about it that's really positive. I mean, well, I liked Elliot Goldenthal taking over the score for Batman Forever
yeah.
and Batman and Robin, but you can't even hear his score under the noise of the effects and the,
well, you know,
and the sound.
As a guilty pleasure, I can tell you that I enjoy what Arnold did in the movie.
The Iceman cometh.
I mean, it's totally over the top and silly. And they're even making a caricature of Arnold, because everything is an Arnold line. You know, everybody, chill. You know what I mean? And then shooting everybody. And it's always some kind of, you know, ice joke, you know? And it was just too much. You know, no one would talk that way. But yeah, it's just so over the top. And this whole Batman and Robin fighting each other thing, it's like, shut up, you know?
You're never going to trust me.
Well, and it's a crowded movie, too. They were trying to get in Poison Ivy and Bane and Batgirl.
Yeah.
And giving her a whole new origin spin. And no. This film's idea of character development is a Lost Boys bike race.
Yeah.
You know?
It's so bad.
And let's get that music video song in there. And,
yeah.
It's just ill-conceived.
I loved how she could, you know, she finds the Batcave, and she automatically has an outfit.
I'd like to help Batman and Robin.
I anticipated you would, and took the liberty to create something in your size.
Suit me up, Uncle Alfred.
Oh yeah, it's built and ready for her.
He put a couple quarters in the Batman armor machinery and came out, you know, with, you know, fits right snug on her boobs and everything. You know what I mean? And, oh, and by the way, she can already fight.
Oh, of course.
And use all the weapons. So, I mean, you know, no training necessary. You know, at least she looked good, okay? Her and Omar were smoking, okay? They were hot, so, you know, we went away from that. Here's the one thing that I can say is the very, very, very best thing about this movie. This movie has one great golden lining to it, and that's that it was so stinking bad, and it was so poorly received that had this not happened, we would not have gotten Batman Begins.
True enough.
And so, you know, if that's what it took to get us to Batman Begins, so be it. You know, and Akiva Goldsman in the documentary for Batman and Robin talks about how, you know, they take responsibility for what happened. They gave the studio what they wanted and what they were hired to give them. But that, you know, a superhero has to change over time.
I felt very much, and still do, that we were doing exactly what you're supposed to do. I leave the opinion of quality to the individual viewer, but what you're supposed to do with icons is contort them. I mean, the reason that comic books survive over time is that the characters are durable and they are afforded different realizations. They're different lenses through which to see the world. They change and are changed by the world, by the time, by the historical moment that they're in. And without those aborted and perhaps less successful bends and twists, you never get Dark Knight Returns. You will never, ever find a Clint Eastwood version of Batman. And those are the things we want. And that's what we yearn for. We yearn for something old made new spectacularly. And so, you know, that's the job. The job is stand it on its head and see if it stands up or falls down.
A superhero over time has to change. And then sometimes we have to go through this change to get to something else. Which is true, you know what I mean? Obviously, the smart way to go was that they needed to go the way with Batman Begins. Now, Schumacher did talk about in the documentary also that they offered for him to do another one.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, Scarecrow is going to be the enemy.
Mm-hmm.
But he turned it down, and, you know, thank God. We just, that, you know, where could we have gone? So that paved the way, and that died off. And then after that, boy, DC just went into the can. They were done with superheroes for quite a while.
I mean, they had killed their golden goose, you know, and between 89 and 97, that was all they got out of it.
That was it. And
four films.
They got four films, and it was dead, and, you know, we didn't know what was going to happen for Batman. So Batman had a long, long absence.
So really, Batman followed the same pattern as Superman in many ways.
Meanwhile, at Marvel... After the failure of Batman and Robin, Marvel took the opportunity to seize the superhero market by producing bigger budget and better produced films that would catapult them into the domination of the superhero film market for years to come. Film series like Blade, Spider-Man, and X-Men became mainstream megahits, which kept Marvel at the top.
What happened the other night?
I don't remember.
Do you want me to tell you?
Yes.
You died.
What? I didn't die. I mean, look at me. I'm right here.
You died. But you were reborn.
Oh, you're crazy. You are a crazy cat lady.
You're not alone, child. You saved others before you. Look. Catwomen are not contained by the rules of society. You follow your own desires. This is both a blessing and a curse. You are a catwoman. Every sight, every smell, every sound, incredibly heightened. Fierce independence, total confidence, inhuman reflexes.
So I'm not patience anymore?
You are patience. And you are Catwoman.
So 2004, we flash forward, and something really sad was about to happen. Because you're going to see what DC had to offer. They're going to jump back in the game, and they're going to make a movie. It's been a long time since they've made a film.
Mm-hmm.
And the one film they decide to make is Catwoman.
Which has been on the board since around 92 after Batman Returns came out. They've been talking about a Catwoman spinoff movie.
Right.
They waited so long they couldn't even use Michelle Pfeiffer.
Yeah, and they couldn't use Michelle Pfeiffer, and Ashley Judd was set up to do it. And then eventually Halle Berry jumped in there. And sadly to say, this is the one film that I really wanted to see before we did this episode, but I haven't seen it. But I know you've seen it.
I saw it.
And
Pete Off. Let's go hire the guy that did the effects for the French guy that directed the fourth Alien movie.
Pete Off. Look, if you're going to go by one name, you better rock. You know what I mean? You better bring something to the table. You don't go by, you know, one name and then die. You know, like X versus Sever. What was that guy's name?
Oh, Chaos?
I don't remember. But it was
his name was Chaos.
Yeah. Look, just, you know, keep it on an internet handle. You know what I mean? Just, you know,
Yeah, Catwoman is, I mean, it's not a great script to begin with. Mm-hmm. Halle Berry, unfortunately, doesn't have a lot to bring to her character of Patience. She's fine in the costume, but her line readings are kind of hard to take, but the dialogue doesn't help her in that department either. Pete Off has some interesting visual ideas, but he's like a lot of these other directors out there. He can't hold a scene. I mean, I don't think there's a shot in Catwoman that's longer than, you know, 4 or 5 seconds before it cuts to another one throughout the whole movie.
Yeah.
And it's just plowing through, you know, its material. And, you know, I guess it has sort of a campy Kish quality to it.
Yeah.
If you're into that kind of thing. I don't know. I thought it was generally pretty poor.
I know the circles you travel in, the occult, exorcisms. I need to understand.
You don't want to know what's out there. Trust me on this.
What if I told you that God and the devil made a wager for the souls of all mankind? No direct contact with humans. That would be the rule. Just influence. See who would win.
Demons stay in hell. Angels in heaven.
They call it the balance.
I need to see what you see.
You do this, there's no turning back. You see them. They see you. Understand? Welcome to my life.
2005, DC decided to put out a film. Now, this was off of their side label called Vertigo Comics. And they wanted to make a film about their comic called Hellblazer. But they changed it into Constantine. And so we got to see Keanu Reeves chasing down demons and shooting them. Music video director Francis Lawrence moved over. And did you see Constantine?
No, still hadn't seen it.
Okay. I hated it. So, saw it in the theater, hated it. Really don't have much more to say about it other than it was just, you know, by the numbers action horror. Had some cool effects in it, but beyond that, I didn't care. You know, Keanu just muddled through it with his, you know, same, you know, whoa attitude. And, I don't know. I'm sure that, you know, there's probably some kind of a cult following for it, but I thought it was pretty awful.
Where were the other drugs going?
I never knew. I don't know. I swear to God.
Swear to me!
You travel the world. Now you must journey inwards. What you really fear is inside you. There is no turning back.
Your parents' death was not your fault. The training is nothing. The will is everything.
If you make yourself more than just a man, if you devote yourself to an ideal, you become something else entirely. Are you ready to begin?
Maybe it's just huge to us at the Hollywood Saloon, but to me, I would arguably say it's one of the best movies we've talked about for this entire, you know, 12-hour show here. And it was a relaunch. But, you know, DC did it smart. They went and got someone who was not going to ham this thing up. They went the other way than they went. You know, they learned from their mistakes.
If anything, DC got out of the way.
Right.
And said, hey, maybe we don't know everything
right.
about making a good Batman movie. Let's get someone who does, and let's bring them in, and let's right. let them, you know, go wild. You know, certainly get David Goyer to write it, Christopher Nolan to co-write it and direct it, you know, mm-hmm. and casting the ideal Bruce Wayne character.
Right.
You know, someone that was going to personify the dual nature, you know, what is disturbing and, you know, what is yearning inside mm-hmm. the character of Bruce Wayne. I mean, it was mm-hmm. the first time we've really seen that realized on film.
Right.
And, yeah, it was time to reboot that series, you know. Absolutely. Well,
and they rebooted it correctly. I mean, it took place in a real-world environment. It wasn't this over-the-top, hammy, Adam West type of Batman, you know, or Joel Schumacher, completely, you know, neon-lit, over-the-top stupidity. This was, you know, if Batman really existed in the real world, maybe this would be what he would be like. You know what I mean? And I think people bought into that, you know. But, you know, you had some big names in there, too. Christian Bale's Batman, obviously, is Batman and Bruce Wayne. Morgan Freeman, Michael Caine, Liam Neeson back in the, you know, the Obi-Wan Qui-Gon role.
Mm-hmm. Gary Oldman,
Ken Watanabe, Rutger Hauer, Katie Holmes, who was replaceable either way. But I had some little interesting tidbits here. This was the first movie that... DC decided to use their logo on.
Right, I noticed that they put that up front.
We got our new DC logo on there because they're here to play now. You know they got something on their hands. And I didn't know this, but this is interesting. Director Christopher Nolan decided there would be no second unit. And so for the whole of the 100%, 129 shooting days, Nolan oversaw every shot of the film personally.
It looks like it.
And that's a good, good thing.
That's the difference between when you hire a filmmaker like Nolan mm-hmm. and a guy like Ratner. I'm sure X-Men has two or three second units, you know? And, I mean, again, it's Nolan had a very specific vision he wanted to bring to the Batman.
Mm-hmm.
And he did. And yeah. It paid off in ways that I think they'll easily get another three or four films out of this series. Without any problems.
Well, let's see where they can go with it. But I got some more interesting notes here. Contrary to the previous Batman films, in which the Batcave was realized as a combination of live set and matte paintings done either by hand or computer, no visual effects were used in this film to show the Batcave. The entire Batcave is instead a massive full-scale set. And that's an interesting thing about Nolan also is that he went in there saying, let's ramp down the CG. You know, let's ramp down these effects and let's not make this an animated film. Let's put this in the real world. Now, obviously, mm-hmm. they had to use some of that. But, you know, there's nothing wrong with miniatures sometimes. There's nothing wrong with old school special effects that still look great and completely believable.
Mm-hmm.
And at least there's someone out there still playing in that ball field. Thank God.
You know, I mean, he wanted his Batman to look like Blade Runner. You know, and he knows how Blade Runner was made.
Well, and check this out. I had this interesting thing, speaking of Blade Runner, on my notes. He says, before the shooting began, Christopher Nolan invited the whole crew to a private screening of Blade Runner. After the film, he said to the whole crew, this is how we're going to make Batman.
Hmm.
So, very cool, you know. I mean, he's got a very, you know, David Fincher-esque quality to him. Which, I mean, is nothing but a good thing.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, we'll take it.
No, I mean, he's a smart, smart filmmaker. And understands the craft and the medium. He can pick up a handheld camera and knows how to go out and get the stuff. You know, he doesn't need right. a crew of 100 to make a movie.
Exactly. And strangely enough, this is the first Batman film to be shot in 2.35.
Oh, you're right. It is.
So,
first one in scope.
Okay, so at this point in the show, what we would normally do is go right into our Superman Returns review. Superman Returns has come out.
Mm-hmm.
What we did was we decided to do a full show for Superman Returns, a full review. What you need to do is go to our special edition page right off the main page, www.hollywoodsaloon.com. go to the special edition link, and boom, you'll see it right there. Superman Returns review. It's a full show. You'll really get into how we felt about the show.
We have one more episode to go in this series, and what we're going to try and do is do a wrap-up of the scorecard between Marvel versus DC, in terms of the feature films at least, and then we'll take a look at what's coming in the future and how that scorecard stands to change or stay the same.
Absolutely, and that'll be our third battle, Battle 3, coming soon to wrap up all this. You know, we've done our presentation shows, and so now we're going to really hit it and see who stands where based on what we've seen in these last two films and in the entire catalog. So thanks for hanging in there. That's Battle 2 coming soon. Battle 3, we're going to wrap it up. Okay, we're going to wrap up this episode. I would like to invite you all to www.hollywoodsaloon.com, our website. You can email us and get in contact with us at hollywoodsaloon@yahoo.com. I just want to mention something real quick. We have been nominated for the People's Choice Podcast Awards, and I want to thank you guys for nominating us. And you can get there by going to www.podcastawards.com. Now, we've been nominated in the cultural and arts category, which is kind of different than what we expected we'd be in, but it's still great. So we're really honored for that. And I just wanted to ask you guys, from now, well, it started on July 28th, but from now until August 11th, could you please go over there to that site and vote for us? And you can vote for us once a day, every day, until August 11th when they shut down the voting process. And we would just be really honored if you would go and do that for us. Now, on our main page at www.hollywoodsaloon.com, we've got a big logo under our Welcome to the Saloon banner. You can't miss it. You click on that, and it'll take you right to that podcast awards. But if you could do that, vote for us. That would be really fantastic. And, you know, and hey, maybe we'll win. Who knows? Okay, we're going to wrap up the old saloon swag from last time. Just want to announce these winners. And Bill Clem from Houston, Texas, won that Kingdom of Heaven Director's Cut DVD. And then we got Jason Wallstrom from Arlington, Texas, and he had won that Mr. and Mrs. Smith Unrated. Mike Bartley from Willow Grove, Pennsylvania, won the Hills Have Eyes Unrated DVD. Adam Eli from San Francisco, California, won the Omen Special Edition set. Jared Hirsch from Goleta, California, won Date Movie Unrated DVD. And then Mike Stevens from San Jose, California, won the Dharma and Greg Season 1 box set. So, man, if you're from California, you did great. And, man, they were lucky this time on Saloon Swag. So we want to definitely thank Fox Home Entertainment, as usual, for these great DVDs. Okay, well, I want to mention our new Saloon Swag, which we got going up. Now, it's been posted for a while because we wanted to get this show out earlier, but it just didn't work out. But it is Super Saloon Swag. That's right. And this one is presented by Warner Home Video. They were very gracious and very cool to send us some Superman-specific stuff just for our DC show. And if you go to our Saloon Swag site, just go to our main page. Right there on the left, you'll see Saloon Swag. You're going to see pictures of these sets and descriptions and everything. But needless to say, they're all Superman and DC hero-centric. We've got Superman Brainiac Attacks, which is a full-length animated cartoon movie. We've got the Justice League Season 2, and of course, that's also an animated, but it's fantastic. We've got The Adventures of Superman Season 3 and 4. Now, for you history buffs out there, this is fantastic. This is the good, you know, the show we mentioned with George Reeves, and it's really just a big, giant slice of history if you want to get that. And then we also have Lois and Clark Season 3. So it's all Superman. It's all good. And the good thing is that we have two copies of each of these to give out. So that gives you even better chances. We're going to push our deadline on this back to August 12th. So until August 12th, you're good. So hey, why don't you go vote for Podcast Awards and then fly over and sign up for Saloon Swag. Super Saloon Swag. So there you go. Hope you like that. Okay, normally we would jump in and do our Frapper Map, but the list is huge, and we are really behind. We're going to catch up real soon in the next show, hopefully, but we're going to skip on that again today since this was a longer show. But as always, at the Hollywood Saloon, we've got a lot of great things for you to do. We've got Saloon Radio, we've got our discussion forums, we've got an email newsletter, which I've been trying to get up and moving again. We've got our special edition page with all kind of extra good stuff. And that's it. So definitely come by, visit us at the Hollywood Saloon, send us an email, vote on the podcast awards, come and get that saloon swag, and there you go. We hope you enjoyed the show. Battle 3 will be coming up pretty soon to wrap it all up. So as always, we thank you for your support, we thank you for listening, and we'll see you next time.
You're listening to the Hollywood Saloon.